This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. You are listening to Healthful Living's radio program, Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. And I'm Julie Matthews, and you can reach us at healthfullivingsf.com. And today we have a great guest on. I'm really, really thrilled. We have Sally Fallon, who is a journalist, chef, nutrition researcher, homemaker, community activist, and the author of two amazing books. The first is Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and the diet dictocrats, and her newer book, Eat Fat, Lose Fat. So for anybody that is not aware, if you are any sort of nutrition consultant, you definitely know who Sally is. Her book, Nourishing Traditions, is probably one of the top five books that any nutrition consultant has to have in their library. So I'm really thrilled to be able to interview her today and to share with some of our listeners and my clients what the principles are all about and why they're so important. Because as you'll notice, as we go through this interview today, they are very different from what we've all been taught for many years. Sally is the founding president of the Weston A. Price Foundation and the editor of the foundation's news, quarterly magazine, as well as she's the founder of a campaign for real milk called realmilk.com. And she also is the president and owner of New Trends Publishing and does so many things. I probably can't even keep up with all of them. So let me see if we can get her on the line. Sally, are you there?
I'm there, Julie. There's some music between us, so.
Oh boy! All right,
there we go.
Yes. Thank you. That was me. All right. So, thank you so much for being here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Julie.
I'm very excited to have you on. As I mentioned, I'm heavily involved with Weston A. Price, but also your Nourishing Traditions cookbook. I just think that, you know, it's so important. There's so much great information, especially I work a lot with kids, so there's great information on kids and especially infants and your great infant formulas and all of those things. So I'm really excited to have you on today.
That was when Mary Enig and I wrote the book. That was our number one target audience was children. We were just so appalled at the dietary recommendations that were coming from our government and from all of these large organizations which were promoting this a low-fat diet for children and telling parents that children shouldn't be on butter and whole milk and minimize eggs, all of the really critical foods in the Western diet that children need to reach their full potential.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk mostly about your new book today, but I'm sure I probably won't be able to resist asking you some other questions.
That's okay, Julie.
Great. So maybe you can start a little bit by telling us who Weston A. Price was and how you got involved with his principles and how they've impacted your life.
Right. Well, Weston A. Price was actually a dentist, and he had a very lively practice in the 30s and 40s. He was very into research. He was head of the research department of the National Dental Association. And he was one of these people that asked good questions. And he asked two questions that he then set about to answer, and he published the answers in his wonderful book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. And the first question was, if he went to parts of the world that were isolated from the West, could he find healthy people? And by healthy people, he meant people who had perfect teeth, who didn't have cavities, who had straight, nice, even teeth, and then who, from what he could determine, were free from diseases, who had their children easily, and good reproduction and so forth. And he answered this question with a resounding yes. He spent 10 years traveling to remote parts of the globe, and he found 14 isolated groups with excellent dental health, perfect dental health, and excellent overall health. So then we come to the second question. The second one question was, what were these people eating? What is a healthy diet? What is a diet that supports good health generation after generation? Well, there were a lot of different diets. The Eskimo diet was mostly fats, 80% fats, and all animal foods. And then he found diets that had grains, and some diets had milk. And so the diets were all very different, and that's kind of good news. It means that there's a lot of different diets that we could follow and be healthy. But here is the real critical thing. These diets were very, very high in nutrients, particularly in vitamins A and D, and we get those nutrients from the very foods we're being told not to eat. We get it from, get them from organ meats. We get them from seafood like shellfish, old-fashioned supplements like cod liver oil, and the butterfat and egg yolks from animals who are outside on pasture. So we need to go back to using butter and eggs and eating liver once a week like our ancestors did. Children need cod liver oil to make sure they get an adequate amount of these nutrients.
Absolutely. So with the information, one of the things I just wanted to point out that I think is interesting on Weston A. Price is, while he was a dentist, when he was looking at teeth, he wasn't looking at only cosmetic things around teeth. He was well aware that the health and the structure of the teeth and the mouth directly correlated to the health of the individuals as well.
Yes, that was the easiest way for him to determine what a person's health was, and he took meticulous notes. He, for example, if he came to a tribe of 100 people, he lined everybody up and counted cavities and noted dental deformities. In fact, in Africa, he found 7 tribes of 100 or more people and 0 cavities, not a single person had a cavity. But, you know, this was not an unusual idea in the times. That's the way they looked at recruits in the armed forces. They looked at their teeth. And if they had bad teeth, they were rejected because it was assumed that they were unhealthy.
Wow. So maybe we can start with a couple of the probably most pressing questions about fats, because there's been so much misinformation. In fact, I remember back, I think it was in the 80s maybe, where fat was definitely the enemy and everything was low fat. And a lot of that still carries over to today. Now, of course, now we have the fat's not necessarily the enemy. Now carbohydrates are the enemy, but still you have people that are now doing low carb and low fat. And
oh, I know, it's kind of crazy. Well, the fats were made the enemy in the 80s. We have to have the recommendation for very high carb diets. And what have we seen? An epidemic of obesity. In spite of what we're being told, fats do not cause weight gain in the same way that carbohydrates do. You can eat more fat and not gain weight than the carbohydrates. Why that is, I'm not quite sure. I think it has to do with how we use fats in the body. And it's almost as though the body is saying, well, if you're not going to give me fats, the fats that I want, then I'm just going to make fat more efficiently and pack it in there. And, of course, those fats in our body are carrying out all kind of roles that we should be getting from the fats in our diet.
Yeah, it's interesting because we sort of see the human body like a machine, that you have a certain amount of energy that you put in and a certain amount of exact energy you get out the other end. And if that were the case, then calorie counting would be an exact science. But we know that that's not true. We know that certain carbohydrates, like lots of sugars, can increase insulin and increase fat storage. And we know that certain fats can actually help us burn fat. And so while there's some truth to the calorie thing, that, you know, there is a limit to the amount of food we can eat before we need to start storing it, it is not as simple as saying that eating fat causes fat. In fact, people always ask me if certain fat foods are fattening.
So, well, you know, anything eaten to extreme excess is going to put weight on, even protein. But
right.
The other side of the equation is how efficient the body uses the calories that it's getting. And if it's not using them very efficiently, then we'll gain weight even with a low amount of calories. And there's one very interesting study that was never published, but we talk about it in the book Eat Fat, Lose Fat, and it was presented to the Obesity Society but not published. And this was a diet where everything was controlled. In other words, they ate only what was given to them, so they knew exactly how many carbs and fats and so forth. And interestingly enough, the people who had the high-fat diet lost a lot more weight, even though they had more calories in their diet. And so it was really quite an interesting study, and it validates what we've been saying, that not all calories are alike.
Right. Yeah. So do you know how eating fat could possibly help us lose weight then?
Well, fats contain a lot of nutrients that your body needs for a healthy thyroid gland. They are required for energy and cell membranes. And, of course, in Eat Fat, Lose Fat, we talk about one particular fat that the body does not store. These are called medium-chain triglycerides, which are very high in coconut oil. Mm. And your body uses these for energy, for quick energy. So they boost your metabolism. There have actually been studies showing that the types of fats in coconut oil make your raise your body temperature a little bit. So they make that fat-burning machine work better.
Mm.
And this gets you over the hump that so many dieters encounter. They lower their carb, their calorie intake, and the body says, oh, I must be in a famine mode, so it slows down the metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, no matter how little you eat, you can't lose weight. So the coconut oil kind of jump-starts your metabolism and gets you over that problem that most dieters have.
Wow. Now, you know there's going to be 1,000 people here on the listening saying, wait, I remember in the 90s, I think it was the 90s, the coconut oil got the big bad rap, that coconut oil, we threw all saturated fats out, and coconut oil is one of the worst things. You wanted to make sure that was not listed in your ingredient list. So how do we explain that to people? If you eat coconut oil, are you going to be more susceptible to heart disease and all those other things?
You know, that is such an unfair demonization of coconut oil. The parts of the world where they eat a lot of coconut oil have the lowest rates of heart disease and also the lowest rates of cancer of anywhere else in the world. The anti-coconut oil campaign was mostly carried out by an organization called Center for Science and the Public Interest, which had this very well-publicized campaign to get it out of the popcorn in the movie theaters. They were also the ones who wanted the fast food people to stop using tallow, that's beef fat, for the French fries.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, what we got was trans fats.
Mm-hmm.
So this organization is the number one organization responsible for the huge influx of trans fats into the diet. And they were warned at the time. My co-author, Dr. Enig, wrote to them and told them that what we were going to end up with was very unhealthy fats in the diet when the tallow and the coconut oil were not unhealthy. They were good for you.
Who are these people at the Center for Science and the Public Interest? Were they just misinformed? Were they lobbyists for the trans fat industry?
Well, the charitable explanation is that they were just well-intentioned but misinformed. However, we found it very interesting that during this campaign against the tallow in the French fries, they thank the soybean oil industry in their literature for their support. So it looks like there is some kind of connection there with the soybean industry, and of course that was the industry that benefited from this campaign. All of a sudden, instead of using tallow from cows, from beef, the whole fast food industry switched to partially hydrogenated soybean oil.
Can we take a step back here and talk about trans fats and how, you know, so we were using saturated fats. Now instead they're using trans fats, but maybe we can define that for some people out there so they can understand why that might not be as healthy as everybody thought before.
Yeah, what is a trans fat? And of course my co-author Mary Enig is the world's experts on trans fats. When you take an oil out of a seed, it is a liquid oil, and you cannot use liquid oils for things like frying, for making cookies, for baked goods. You need what's called a shortening, which is a solid fat. And so traditionally, people use butter, lard, tallow, and coconut oil for baked goods. Well, that was a huge market, so the edible oil industry, figured out how to manipulate these liquid oils and make them hard, and that process is called partial hydrogenation. And it basically rearranges the fat molecules and creates what's called trans fats, which are different from the fats that your body is used to. And when you eat a lot of trans fats, they get built into your cell membranes. See, every cell in your body is surrounded by a membrane of billions of cells, of fat cells. And so once you have a lot of these trans fats in your membranes, your body can't make reactions the way it used to do. It can't support enzymatic activity. Various receptors can't work. Insulin receptors don't work. And so all sorts of things start to go wrong. And this is exactly what we've seen. These trans fats have been implicated in everything from heart disease to infertility to weak bones, learning disabilities in children. They do cross the placenta in the mother, and they interfere with neurological development.
Oh, boy.
They also get into mother's milk if she's nursing and eating trans fats. So we have a huge problem here, and it's starting to be recognized, of course, but the so-called establishment is still telling us, well, don't eat trans, but the saturates are also just as bad. And that is actually totally untrue. The saturates have good effects on the body, the opposite effects to the trans fats.
How do you think the saturated fats got such a bad name, or what was it in there that I know some people would say, well, you know, butter has cholesterol, and cholesterol is found in the arteries, therefore all saturated fats must be bad. But coconut oil doesn't even have cholesterol because it's not from an animal. So I don't know if you have any way to reconcile or help people understand this a little more thoroughly, because it's quite confusing from everything that we'd heard in the past.
Right. Well, saturated fats are found mostly in animal fats. Butter and the fat on your meat is mostly saturated. That's why it's firm at room temperature. By the way, it's not firm in your body because your body is not at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
The trans fats are still stiff in your body, but the animal fats are just like butter will get nice and soft if you get it to 98 degrees. This anti-saturated fat campaign has been going on since the 1950s, and it was a deliberate campaign by the edible oil industry. They worked behind the scenes to get doctors and researchers to demonize their competition. And Mary and I have told this story in an article called The Oiling of America. We actually name names and say what happened. That's posted on our website, westonaprice.org, but I think if you just Google Oiling of America, you'll find it.
So we talked about losing waste, not just a matter of calorie counting or willpower. What are the special properties in coconut oil that are helpful for the body?
Well, as we mentioned before, the coconut oil boosts your metabolism. So this is an unusual diet plan in that it gives you more energy than you expect to have when you're on a diet. The other wonderful thing about coconut oil is that it provides a feeling of satiation. And this is, we have had such wonderful feedback on this. Someone will say, you know, I wanted to eat this whole plate of food, but for the first time in my life, I actually could not eat everything on my plate. And it's not a question of willpower. It's a question of the body saying, I've had enough. I've had enough. And what we suggest people do is about 20 minutes before they sit down to their meal, which is a high-fat meal but relatively small portions, they consume 1 to 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, and you put the coconut oil in some herb tea or warm water and just sip that coconut oil. And you'll find that by the time you sit down to eat, you're actually not very hungry at all. So it also works as an appetite suppressant.
And is that specific to coconut oil then versus could you do that with another type of fat?
Yes, you could do that with another type of fat, but of course, we're recommending coconut oil because it's almost like free calories.
Mm-hmm.
Your body is using those for energy and it's not storing them.
Because of the medium chain triglycerides.
Right.
I had also heard that coconut oil is very rich in lauric acid, which is found in breast milk, and in caprylic acid, which helps kill candida yeast overgrowth.
Right. The lauric acid is one of these medium chain triglycerides, and it's very high, and about 50% of them, of these fatty acids in coconut oil, are lauric acid. And lauric acid is unusual among all the medium chain triglycerides are good for boosting metabolism. And they also have antimicrobial properties, and lauric acid is the strongest of these for antimicrobial properties. That means that in the intestinal tract, these fatty acids fight against fungus like candida, they fight against viruses, they fight against bad bacteria, parasites. So the lauric acid and these other medium-chain triglycerides are really great for people who are struggling with candida and all of these types of infections and digestive problems.
I was going to ask you a question about that. Boy, I have so many questions going on at one time. Well, I'm sure that I will think of it any moment here. Lauric acid. Boy.
Yeah. That's the 12 carbon fatty acid.
I remember now. Do they need to be consumed raw in order for them to have those nutritional properties? I know if you do things like roast nuts and at too high of a temperature, you kill or you destroy some of the good fatty acids. So is that the reason that you recommend drinking it in a tea, or could you also saute something in the coconut oil and also get the good properties?
It's okay if they're heated. Of course, you want to treat all fats with care and not heat them too high a temperature. Actually, I found in working on the book and all the wonderful coconut-based recipes in the book that I actually did not prefer cooking in pure coconut oil because it burns at a lower temperature than butter does, and so it burns quite easily. And when coconut oil is burnt, it really smells terrible. So what we suggest in the book is a blend of oils. It's one-third olive oil, one-third coconut oil, and one-third cold-pressed sesame oil. And this makes a very nice cooking fat and also very good for salads. So it's a way of putting coconut oil in your salads.
If coconut's solid at room temperature, then how do you do that?
Well, you melt it a little bit first.
Okay.
And it stays liquid in this blend.
Hmm.
By the way, coconut oil makes a very good thermometer because if it's, in the high 70s, it will start to get very soft.
It's so cold in San Francisco in the summer that I never had that experience, but one day it got so warm that my coconut oil melted for the first time ever.
Well, ours is very liquid right now this time of year.
So you were talking about insulin resistance or diabetes and some of these things. And you also, I know that MSG has come up before. What can you talk about MSG and how is that involved in weight gain far more than these things like these good fats are?
Yes, now this is most interesting, Julie, and it's something that the public is totally unaware of. But one of the ways that they get, is, well, let's put it this way. Researchers like to study obese animals. And they start off with these animals, and they have to get them fat very quickly. And the way they do it is to feed them MSG. MSG makes the animals get fat.
Hmm.
Now, MSG is in all processed food. It's usually not labeled. It's in foods that say spices or even natural flavors. You get this sort of general label like this. It almost certainly is hiding the fact that MSG is in there.
Mm-hmm.
So we do really caution people, if you're going on this diet, you want to eliminate all of these hidden causes of weight gain, and MSG is number one. So that means that you're really preparing your own food. You're using real whole foods that you've prepared yourself. It doesn't mean that you have to spend a lot of time in the kitchen, but you do have to spend some time in the kitchen. You can't do this diet on processed foods.
That makes sense to anybody that's looking at trying to get the best nutrition anyway, is that processed foods are pretty much devoid of most of that and wouldn't really be prevalent in a highly nutritious diet anyway. So it makes it pretty easy if you start really being interested in your nutrition that you're probably not going to end up buying many of these processed foods with this MSG to begin with.
Well, the MSG is there because otherwise the food would have no taste or
mm-hmm.
taste terrible. And, of course, one of the reasons these processed foods have no taste is they don't have a lot of good fats in them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the fats that provide a lot of taste in the normal foods that we eat.
Very true. So another fat that Weston A. Price Principles talks a lot about is the cod liver oil. So that's another fat here. What can you talk about? I know that it's recommended, and it's very high in vitamin A and vitamin D. And so what's the benefit of cod liver oil, and is there just another way somebody might be able to get their fat-soluble vitamins like that with some other food?
Some other food. Well, the cod liver oil is the richest source of A and D on the planet. And I'm not talking about fish oil now. I'm talking about a fish liver oil, such as cod liver oil. And it's a very important component of our diet because we've had studies showing that, first of all, vitamin D is critical to weight loss, but also vitamin A is so important for thyroid function. And we really do address the problem of sluggish thyroid in this book. The coconut oil boosts metabolism, and the vitamin A supports thyroid function. So we're recommending 10,000 to 20,000 units of vitamin A from food, and really the easiest way to do this is with cod liver oil. Now, don't panic, because you can take it in capsules, and there's a few brands that we recommend. And some of the newer cod liver oils and mint-flavored cod liver oil have absolutely no fishy taste.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend that you mix them with a little water so you don't have the oily sensation on your tongue when you take it.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically just swallow it, and it's not unpleasant at all. Other foods that provide vitamin A are liver, and we have some great liver recipes in the book. But, of course, liver is an acquired taste, and not everyone will eat liver.
Mm-hmm.
And then the butterfat and the egg yolks from animals on pasture. And, in fact, the vitamin A in butterfat is the most easily absorbed of any food. But that means, of course, you have to find some really good butter. And, fortunately, in California, that's readily available in your health food stores.
What should people look for when you say on pasture? What might people look for in a butter? If it's organic, is that good enough? What might they want to look for on a label that would help them make sure they got the best fat possible?
Right. Well, if it's just organic, it's not necessarily mean that these cows have been eating green grass. The green grass is critical. The cow is a machine for turning green grass into healthy fats and healthy milk. And the carotenes in the green grass is what the cow turns into vitamin A. Very efficiently, and does this for us. Now, most cows in this country are in confinement, especially in California, and even much of the organic milk sold is from cows in confinement. They may be getting organic food, but it's not green grass.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are some dairies in California where the cows are outside, and we do provide a very lengthy resource list in the book, so you can find these good products.
Great. So I know that Weston A. Price talks a lot about the primitive people or the original diets, the traditional diets, and has a kind of a list of, I guess, sacred foods, you might say.
Right.
What are some of those for people?
Well, and the sacred foods were the foods that they gave to pregnant women and to children and to nursing women, growing children, and to make sure that they grew up healthy and strong. And it depended on what part of the world they were in. In many cultures, liver was a sacred food. In the milk-drinking cultures, the butterfat was a sacred food, especially the butter from cows eating the rapidly growing, very bright green grass in the spring and fall. That was a sacred food. In fact, in Switzerland, where he went, they had a ceremony in their churches to honor this butter, this wonderful spring butter. In some cultures, it was fish heads or fish livers. In some cultures, it was various organs from different animals. Shellfish were also sacred foods in many cultures.
Hmm. I would assume you run into some challenges because so much of this information is different than what we've heard in the past. I can understand how it would be very confusing for somebody, or that they just... a lot of the foods that I now love are things that people would think I'm crazy. You know, I grow sauerkraut on my counter and, kombucha on my counter. And, all these fermented foods are very new to people. Maybe we should actually take a second, because fermented foods are one of my favorites. I'd love to hear what Weston A. Price found in other cultures about their use of fermented foods and why they're so helpful.
Well, you know, Weston Price did not describe fermented foods. He was really looking at the nutrients in the diet, and he didn't stay long enough to really see how they were preparing foods. That comes with some of my other research into traditional diets. And in fact, all traditional diets did contain fermented foods. Now, these are foods prepared by a process called lactofermentation that increases the amount of lactic acid, and the lactic acid acts as a preservative. But the lactic acid is also very good for you, and the enzymes and the nutrients and the good bacteria that proliferate during this process are all also very good for you. You know, Julie, when my first book came out, Nourishing Traditions, everything was so strange about the book that it kind of was met with complete silence. But it just sort of grew and grew. It was by word of mouth, and people started experimenting with these foods, finding out how much fun they were and how much they helped them. Mm-hmm. So now, of course, these fermented foods are a buzzword, and a lot of people are doing them even commercially. Mm-hmm. I'll be explaining all of this step by step, how the diet works. I'll talk about lacto-fermented foods and butter and Weston Price at the Learning Annex on Thursday, July 28th. I'm speaking at the Crown Plaza Hotel, and that's in the evening.
Great.
So your listeners can go on to learningannex.com for information on this, or there is a phone number that you can call in San Francisco, 415-788-5500.
Great. So for people that just tuned in, this is Sally Fallon talking about Eat Fat, Lose Fat on KPOO San Francisco. And I'm Julie Matthews, and we're just talking about the role of these traditional foods in our diet and these the importance of some of these fats that we that may be, quote, new to some of us, but not new in general. So if I can ask you a couple more questions, just some general things about some of these sacred foods, I'd love to dispel a few of these myths because there's things I feel pretty strongly about. So one of my favorites is raw milk.
Yes.
And, you know, it is so scary. Everything you've ever heard is you don't let anybody have raw milk products, especially immune-compromised people and pregnant women and children and all of this. And, you know, I understand, based on all of that propaganda, how these foods can be really scary, and I'm hoping that we can dispel some of that and also bring in to their awareness some of the really important qualities of raw milk and raw milk products that you can't get from pasteurized.
Right. And it's great that I am coming to California to give these talks, because in California, raw milk is legal. You can go into any health food store in the state and buy it, and we actually have a couple of wonderful dairies selling raw milk in California. And, of course, if you talk about raw milk to anybody in the government, they look at you in horror, as if mm-hmm. this is the most dangerous food on the planet. You know, Julie, if you go to the Center for Disease Control website and look at what they have posted up there, articles about raw milk and their own statistics about other food, and you do the math, you find that actually raw milk is much safer than any other food. You're 2.5 times more likely to get sick from pasteurized milk than from raw milk, and you're 3.5 times more likely to get sick from other foods than raw milk.
Wow.
And, of course, the greatest source of foodborne illness is fruits and vegetables, lettuce and salads and fruits and things, and yet our government tells us to eat at least five servings of fruits and vegetables per day. So these haven't been taken off the market. And when we have an outbreak of foodborne illness from pasteurized milk, which happens quite frequently, that's not taken off the market. So there's a double standard applied to raw milk, which has to, be absolutely perfect, and it is almost perfect, only when the conditions are extremely dirty and the cows are very sick, as in confinement dairies, would you want to avoid raw milk.
That's a good point, because I would guess that one of the reasons that pasteurization came around was to allow for more mass production of this milk, because you didn't have to worry as much if they had bacteria, because you were going to attempt to kill all that with pasteurization anyway.
Exactly. It allowed the dairy industry to concentrate and to put lots and lots of cows together in very unhealthy conditions. When the cows are outside on pasture and they're healthy, you actually do not find any pathogens in their milk. Organic Pastures Dairy, which has sold 22 million servings of raw dairy in the state of California without ever having an incident, and they've never found a pathogen in the milk. And there's a reason for this. Milk is an amazing substance that is full of bioactive components that seek out and kill bad bacteria, and that also prime the immune system to be able to deal with bad bacteria. And mother's milk is not sterile. It's got lots of bad bacteria in it that the baby picks up that come from her skin. Mm-hmm. And what happens with the milk is that it actually programs the baby to be immune to any bacteria it comes in contact with as an infant. Hmm. And when you pasteurize milk, you basically destroy all of these immune factors. And so instead of helping your immune system, your body mounts an immune response and thinks that it's getting a toxin. And that's why more and more people are allergic, quote-unquote, to pasteurized milk. The customer base is shrinking because fewer and fewer people can actually tolerate it.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's something in my practice. I work a lot with kids with autism, and many of them are casein intolerant. But after we work on healing the gut for a while, they're able to go to eating the raw dairy products, and they're not able to while they're not able to eat the pasteurized dairy products.
Yeah, and I think the inspectors and the people who are trying to prevent us from having raw dairy, they need to just hear a mother sometime talk about how they found this wonderful food that their autistic child will actually consume. Mm-hmm. You know, these children can be very picky. And it's the first food that they found that the child can actually digest, and it's making him better.
Mm-hmm.
It's helping the autism. I mean, we hear story after story like this. How dare anyone tell us that children can't have this wonderful food?
Right. Mm-hmm. I had heard a great story from Sandor Katz, who's the author of Wild Fermentations, who has lectured around the country and certainly even other parts of the world about all of his experience with fermented foods. And he said that out of his entire experience, he's never had anybody get food poisoning from any sort of fermented, raw fermented foods, including raw dairy. And he told me a very fascinating story. I don't know if you have any, if you've heard this before or if this is new, but he had said that if you leave raw and pasteurized dairy on the counter, the raw milk will turn to yogurt and be edible, and the pasteurized milk will grow any of, there isn't the good lactobacillus in there, but there's some strain, you know, small little amounts of bad strains of bacteria, and if you leave it on the counter, it will putrefy, and we all know what that's like. It goes bad, and you can't consume it anymore. And then he also mentioned if you inoculate raw dairy or pasteurized dairy with a bad bacteria, that the good lactobacillus in the raw dairy will actually kill all of that bad bacteria, and you'll end up with milk free of all of those pathogens. But if you do the same thing with pasteurized dairy, because there's no competition, it will grow teeming with the bad bacteria. And I'm wondering if you had any comment or heard anything similar to that.
That is absolutely true. In fact, the University of California recently did exactly that with the raw milk from Organic Pastures. They inoculated it with Campylobacter and E. coli and all the bad guys, and then tested it the next day, and the bad bacteria were gone. And surprisingly, if the milk is at room temperature, this works better than if it's cooled. Whereas pasteurized milk, if it does get infected or, you know, come in contact with bad bacteria, which happens frequently in the processing plants, it will spoil. It will become very dangerous to drink.
I think that's really just a fascinating bit of information that most people probably don't know about. Tell me again what school did that study?
You know, it was, I think, I know it was the University of California. I don't know which one, whether it was Davis or I just don't know.
I will look it up.
But if you go to organicpastures.com, I think you'll find it there.
Oh, great. Yeah. So, okay, I got my fun questions answered around my favorite topics here, raw dairy and fermented
and
foods.
And by the way, dairy is an important part of our eat fat, lose fat diet. We do put a lot of emphasis on calcium. And we actually have a wonderful recipe for those who can't get raw dairy or who can't tolerate any kind of dairy, and there are a few like that, based on whole coconut milk. And we've had a lot of wonderful feedback about this delicious drink.
Mm. What about, let's go back to coconut oil, since that's such a staple of your Eat Fat, Lose Fat book. And I'd love to know, how does the coconut oil affect digestion and those medium-chain triglycerides affect digestion?
It's very helpful for digestion, very helpful because it improves the flora of the digestive tract. Even on down into the colon, the types of bacteria that are good to have in the colon, their favorite food are the medium-chain triglycerides. So the one thing that we do caution people about, if you've been on a low-fat diet for a long time, you do have to start out slowly. So you build up gradually your coconut oil and your cod liver oil.
Is that because the digestive system's not used to releasing the digestive enzymes necessary?
It doesn't release enough bile, and it just needs to be told and reassured that these fats are okay and get the signal so it starts producing the right enzymes and so forth.
So somebody might just start with very small amounts of these and kind of work their way up over the course of, what, a couple of weeks? Or?
Yes, for a few weeks.
Okay.
In fact, there is a pre-diet period where you just get used to all the foods, you get used to doing the cod liver oil and the coconut oil. You don't really count calories in this phase one, we call it, and except that you also minimize carbs. You don't eat desserts or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the initial phase, and many people lose weight just doing that.
Sure.
And then once you've gotten used to that way of eating, then we have quite a restricted diet. It is a reduced calorie diet, but it's not a starvation diet. It's about 2,000 calories a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And people lose weight on this diet.
Yeah, I think it's important to let people know that most diet success is not about really restricting calories as the primary method of weight loss. As we all have seen for how many years now, low-calorie dieting might work in the short term but does not work over the long term. And obviously, we need to, if we're going to maintain a weight, we need to eat that way forever, and it's just not possible to sustain that low-calorie, low-fat diet for...
Well, a low-calorie, low-fat diet, because the body needs fat so badly that it will overcome your willpower.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll
exactly.
be hungry, and you'll be craving, and... what this diet does is satisfies the body's need for fats, and then you don't have the cravings.
Right. So this whole willpower craving thing, we should be listening to our body saying, there's a reason that we're craving these foods, and what might we be deficient in, or what might it be, you know, why might this be the case, and how do we balance that biochemistry or whatever's happening, because ideally, if we're eating healthy foods in healthy quantities, we should be satisfied and we shouldn't be having extreme cravings for any particular food group. That should be telling our body something.
And actually, we should get a signal. And this is what I've found that this has happened to me. I actually eat far, far less than I used to, because about halfway through my meal, I'll get a signal and I just don't want to eat anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And for so many of the people we've heard from, this is just amazing. It's like a miracle.
Wow.
Before, they had to exercise a lot of willpower and often couldn't, and had to eat the whole plate of food.
And then for people that are culinary experts or gourmets, what are the advantages in cooking? You talked a little bit about the oil combination that you put together. Why is it there an advantage, or what is the advantage that people might also see from the perspective of preparing their foods?
Well, I do want to recommend the book, my book, Eat Fat, Lose Fat, to people who just like to cook and even don't need to lose weight, because I had so much fun with the recipes in this book.
Mm.
And we got recipes based on coconut, either using coconut milk or coconut cream or the coconut meat, from many, many parts of the world, and they are surprisingly easy recipes. there are some wonderful dessert recipes in the book. And it was just so much fun to put all these recipes together.
Mm. That sounds great. And for people that haven't cooked with coconut oil, it imparts such a delicious flavor.
Right, right. Although I got a letter from someone that said, I don't like the taste of coconut. Ah. But there are certain coconut oils that have no taste.
So. Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I actually use 100% coconut oil in, not in all of my cooking, but as opposed to doing a one-third, one-third, one-third okay. blend. And I've actually haven't had any problems with burning of the oil. And I think if you're going to make a healthy French fry or a healthy French toast or something, it adds a really great flavor to it while not smoking and oxidizing your fats at the same time.
Well, you do have to be careful, though, not to heat it too high. Maybe I just cook it at a slightly higher temperature than you do. You get a metallic taste, a lot of people don't like that.
Yeah, I could imagine. I could understand that. It's interesting that I haven't had that experience. I'll have to play around with it a little bit more. So tell us where you're going to be so people can get a hold of you. You're going to be at the Learning Annex on the 28th.
Yes, that's Thursday the 28th, and that particular one is at the Crown Plaza Hotel. You can go on to learningannex.com for details and to register, or you can call them, 415-788-5500. Then the next day starts a three-day conference, which I'm doing with Tom Cowan, who is a physician in San Francisco, and a wonderful expert on movement and exercise, Jamin McMillan. The three of us were authors of a book called The Fourfold Path to Healing.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was the principal author of that. And that is an all-weekend seminar with three tracks for the three different speakers. I'll be going into a lot more detail, or you can listen to Tom Cowan, who's a wonderful speaker. And Jamin is most interesting. I'm sure that everyone would love watching what he does. And that's all weekend long. And if you go to fourfoldhealing.com, you can get all of the details on that conference. And there's also a phone number, 510-741-8242. And one of the things I want to stress at the weekend conference is that the food is going to be delicious.
Mm.
Jessica Prentice is doing all the food. She'll be following our guidelines. And you can prove to yourself that this is not a restrictive type of eating. It's actually a liberating type of eating, and the food really does taste good.
Absolutely. I do know Jessica, and she has made many, many recipes using these principles. And like you said, the more high quality the ingredients are, the more wonderful the food tastes. So people always assume that, quote, health food is going to taste bad. But I beg to differ that if you're eating all of this processed junk, and then you need to add salt and sugar and MSG on top of it, boy, compare that to just some, not only butter, but take butter that's raw and grass-fed. It's the flavor is something you've probably never experienced before.
Right. By the way, the seminar over the weekend, the Fourfold Path Conference, is at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center.
Okay.
It's a beautiful facility.
Great. How else can people get in touch with you and your work?
Well, probably the best thing for people to do is to go to our big website, which is westonaprice.org, westonaprice.org. And if you're completely unfamiliar with our work, we actually have a tour that takes you to through the most important articles on the website. Our other website is realmilk.com. Helps you find raw milk wherever you may live. And then Nourishing Traditions and the Fourfold Path to Healing, you can go to the publishing company, which is newtrendspublishing.com.
Great. And I am part of the local San Francisco chapter, and they have a local website too, which is Weston A. Price San Francisco, all spelled out. And there are some great resources to dry cleaners that don't use chemicals and natural eggs and dairy and all sorts of good holistic practitioners. So it can be a great resource. And we also have potlucks and food co-ops and all sorts of things related to the Weston A. Price Foundation.
Well, you know, these local chapters, we have over 300 local chapters now all over the world, and they allow us to put our money where our mouth is. You know, it's one thing to say you should be eating these types of food, and then another thing to help people find the foods, and that's what our local chapters do. And our San Francisco chapter is a very vibrant chapter. I'm looking forward to seeing you all over the weekend and on Thursday evening. We're going to have a great time.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Sally, thank you so much for being with me today. It's been really great to get to talk to you in person.
Well, Julie, I look forward to seeing you on the 28th or over the weekend, which is the 29th through 31st, the Fourfold Path Conference.
All right. Sounds wonderful. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.